You might remember me from such projects as the new React.dev and ReactNative.dev documentation. I used to lead a web animations community and work on that API with the W3C. I loved open source and MDN. My life's goal is to teach the world to code, but long before all these wonderful things, I was a teenager on a farm in the middle of nowhere, Virginia, wrangling geese and putting comics online using a bootleg copy of Photoshop.
My name is Skolp Mietling, and this is the Mechanical Ink Podcast, a podcast about open source, the open web, sustainability, and those who want to make the web and the world a better place. Hey, Rachel, and welcome to the Mechanical Ink Podcast.
Hey, it's so good to see you, Shalk. How are you doing?
Pretty good, pretty good. Temperature could be a couple of degrees cooler, but other than that, it's all good. How are things over there in your neck of the woods?
Could be a couple of degrees warmer, but you know how things are. I was just hanging out in Amsterdam a few hours ago, and it's a little warmer there, so a taste of the spring to come.
Oh,
I take it you're getting ready for winter.
Yes, please. It can't really come sooner. I'm much more of a winter person than a summer person, to be completely honest.
I'm a winter person myself, so I'm happy with the long springs and falls that you get in Europe.
Yeah, those are good too. Summer, I don't know. It's just getting too hot. Yeah. But
well, we're being very British here talking about the weather.
Yeah, that's true. But it's always interesting because, you know, these days when you do a podcast, it's not like, you get some of the big names who literally sit down next to the other person. But generally, we do these things over the internet. So it's always so interesting because you speak with people all over the world.
Exciting.
With that said, I had a look at your website, which you then told me is very old and needs to be updated. I know the feeling.
My website is
in much the same state. But be that as it may, I learned that you were an award-winning cartoonist. So that is something I'm curious about. And then now there's the React Core team. And then there's these two topics that I'd like you to... I'm going to just put it out of context, and then you can put them into context. Goose wrangling and Photoshop.
Well, I can give you and your listeners the deets. Hi there, I am Rachel Neighbors. You might remember me from such projects as the new React.dev and ReactNative.dev documentation. Among other things, I used to lead a web animations community and work on that API with the W3C. I loved open source and MDN. My life's goal is to teach the world to code, but long before all these wonderful things, I was a teenager on a farm in the middle of nowhere, Virginia, wrangling geese and putting comics online using a bootleg copy of Photoshop. And I had to build websites and shopping carts and newsletters. And so I had to learn to code to do those things because we did not have Wix or Etsy or MailChimp back then. You had to install OS Commerce and Tin Can PHP and have your own PHP server. It was pretty cool. It was definitely a different era, but that's how I got here and that's what I'm doing now.
Nice. Yeah, no, I mean, wow, if the tools and the things that's just available these days are really mind-blowing. Like, I come also from the generation, I guess, where if you wanted anything, you kind of almost started from scratch. Thank goodness for open source. So some things you didn't quite have to start from scratch, but most of these things you definitely needed to. So teaching the world to code, you mentioned that also just now, and that's also your line on LinkedIn. I love that, but I have two questions about it. And the one is a little cheeky, and it's just I'm going to give some context to why I'm asking the question, but I think for me the first part of that is, broadly speaking, how do we make teaching the world to code more accessible to those who want to learn how to code? Because from having spoken to a lot of junior devs or people curious about learning to code, they have many challenges. And one of those is, where do I go? Where do I start? That's one of the biggest questions. How do I know what to trust? There's so much out there. How do I know I'm learning the right thing? And then, like, I think in software, oftentimes people say, even before you write the first line of code, you're going to have to ask whether you should even be writing that line of code. Isn't it better if it doesn't even exist? Because that's the easiest way to avoid a bug, right? Is to not write any code. Now, that's why I wanted to ask, like, why teach the world how to code when there's so many people going around telling us that in 5 years from now, there would be no more coding jobs?
So those are like three questions. There's always going to be coding jobs. It's just what the coding might be will change. Front-end development used to be very different. I used to write CSS and HTML by hand, and then we got processors for CSS, and now we have Tailwind, and we completely seem to be working out of design systems, which it's more of a marketplace, you know, a couple of designers handling a design system so that all these engineers can, you know, Lego brick together different sites. What need is there for somebody to be hand tweaking CSS on a bunch of different pages anymore? It's changed a lot, and that's not a bad thing, but the code that we would have told me to learn back in my day is probably different from the code we told your listeners to learn and the code that future people entering the tech sphere should learn. Should you, you know, give up on learning the basics of programming through podcasts and self-study? No, those are universal truths, and understanding how programming works will just make you better at using whatever tools we come up with in the future. And also, somebody has to actually program all of these things. You think like AI is going to write itself? Doesn't. It needs real people working on it. It doesn't hurt to start skilling up and understanding how the future of technology works. You know, once I read this book called Grokking Deep Learning, and once I'd put together my very first little model, I was very disappointed because it was just math. It's just a little prediction engine. Oh my gosh, like the magic is gone. And what you want when you're in any job is to be inspired to use the tools that are given to you, but to not see them as magic, to see them as commonplace. This is why I think just using, you know, just using APIs and grabbing things and throwing them around is a little bit different from understanding what's happening under the hood. Like, yeah, anybody can slap up a database, but it behooves you to study up what different databases are, how you know what the performance of a good database is, the difficulties of sharding, just so that you can make informed decisions about which tech stack you're going to reach for, which tool you're going to use. So we might be learning different kinds of code in the future, but I wouldn't say that we're going to stop learning to code or that we don't need to learn to code. Because if that's true, then I think there's a lot of stuff we should just stop learning. Like, we should stop learning how to drive, because cars are going to do that for us in the future. We should stop learning how to cook. We have microwave dinners. We've had them since, like, World War II. Why are we still cooking? We should definitely stop having pets, because we have Tamagotchi now. I mean, come on. Tech is the new way of life, the new way people make money. Oh, did I answer that question? You gave me a handful.
Yeah. No. You definitely answered the why. I mean, those are all extremely good points. So I think now that we know why we should still be teaching the world to code, how do we go about this? How do we ensure that this is accessible? So, you know, when I mean that in the broad perspective, like if I'm somebody interested in learning to code and I'm like, where do I begin? Like, do you have some guidance around that?
Well, unfortunately, boot camps can be a little hit and miss these days. You really have to know that it's a trusted boot camp, that has had good results. Because it's such a for-profit thing, there are, of course, people who are just going to take your money and run, and definitely should be leery of that. For me, I think the best place to start is usually with the best people. So think of your favorite open source library. Who are the core contributors? Can you follow their accounts on GitHub and on Twitter? Can you like start making sure you hear more from them so that you can understand how they're thinking? And then I would recommend actually starting with the like quick starts and tutorials of that that framework or that library. It's the best place to start for anybody, because it's from the source, it's from those people you trust. And as you start building things and having challenges, then you can seek out answers to those problems. I think there's this idea that we're all going to like sit down and read a big book about a program and then we'll be done. I did actually once read through a big book on Photoshop, Photoshop 7. It was my first version of Photoshop. I read it cover to cover. I know all of the hotkeys. I have not read I tried. I could not bring myself to finish a single a single Adobe product manual or education course after that. Once you get the basics down, you don't need to do such deep dives. And I think it's perfectly fine to use the tools that are available, the abundance of resources that these open source teams put together and share. Now, maybe, you know, you're looking at a very complicated project's documentation and quick start tutorials and you can't make heads or tails of it. That's just an indication that you need to pivot to a different project, perhaps one that's a little closer to things you already understand, or that you need to back it up further up the stack. You know, like maybe you're not ready to be understanding edge functions, but what you really need is to just get a boilerplate blog running somewhere first. So you back it up and you start learning Next, and you get Next running on Vercel, and then you start thinking, oh, well, if I built that, maybe I could build something with these edge functions too. And you will start having expanding use cases. And that's where you want to start. Not trying to read the docs on Next.js and Vercel so that you can understand it all and build all the things, but rather just start with the quick start or the getting started tutorial and go from there. Get yourself to Hello World and then try to build your dreams from there.
Yeah, that's great. So essentially, like, one, playing to your strengths, following and learning from the people you already admire, because that's going to give you, you know, a much better indication of trust. Like, don't just look for some random person on YouTube. Like, say, not that there's not good people on YouTube, there are, but
you probably don't know which ones are.
Exactly. Whereas if you start at the source, so to speak, which is like, I don't know, Dan Abramov Evan Yu.
Sebastian Mark Bosch. Yeah. Like, yeah. Go to the core teams. You might not understand all of it, but you can always respond to them and ask them for an explanation. Somebody's going to jump in and explain it to you. Or you could even take their tweet and go to ChatGPT and say, hey, I'm trying to figure out what this person meant. And ChatGPT will try to explain it. And ChatGPT is not terrible. It's a pretty good job of like filling in for that older sister that you could just ask all the questions of when you were growing up. And they're not always going to give you the right answer, but they're going to get you closer. And you know, like, you probably should double tap it. But in a pinch, you can always be like, hey, ChatGPT sister, I don't quite understand what database sharding is. Can you explain that to me as a person who's not really familiar with anything other than MySQL? And you'll get a pretty reasonable answer most of the time. Not perfect, but it gets you closer than your high school teacher.
Yeah, no, for sure. I totally agree. I mean, I think that's probably one of the ways I mostly use these tools. Is to get like a broad understanding or explanation of something. And then if I feel I need to, I can dig deeper from there. But the other interesting thing about that is I was speaking with a junior dev and asked him kind of The question started in a different place. It started from, like, how do you feel about AI and how it will impact jobs? And to some extent, what we started with here, the whole why aspect of it, like, why learn to code when, you know, AI will be doing it for us? The interesting thing that she talked about is, as a junior developer, and I think this doesn't really go away because it's the whole imposter syndrome thing, but you are a little scared sometimes to ask a question of your more senior colleagues because you don't want to look stupid. Now, this is a cultural problem as well, of course, but there it is. A lot, we all struggle with this. And so she finds that sometimes it's easier for her to go to ChatGPT and say, hey, so I've read this thing. Can you explain it to me? And then that gets her closer to the answer, and then she feels less intimidated by then going to somebody for that. And I was like, that's cool. That makes so much sense to me because it's not going to judge, right? It's not going to judge you. It's not going to say, hey, you know what? Why are you asking me this? You should know this. That kind of answer. It's just going to give you an answer. It's not going to judge the question.
Absolutely. And while I wish I could say that there aren't people who will judge you out there and that everyone wants to see you succeed in the industry, the truth is there are some people who just don't have the emotional maturity to be okay with people who don't know the same things they do. They're kind of like at that 8-year-old stage where it's like, yes, but I know all the species of butterflies and you only know the moths. And, you know, like, good for you, kid. I see your parents needed to teach you some better manners. But, you know, it can be intimidating if you're the kid with the moth collection in that conversation. But you should definitely use the conversation that you have with ChatGPT as a fomenting point for a conversation with a real human being. I would hate to think, and one day this will happen, which will make me sad. One day we won't have conversations with each other about code. We'll be too shy. We'll just talk to ChatGPT and bots, and they'll explain it to us, and we'll understand each other even less as a species. So please use this remaining time that we have together to pick each other's brains and get familiar with how they think and how they write code.
Yeah, well said. So, it's hard to pivot to something else after that, but here we go. So I mentioned cartoonist right at the top of the conversation, and you wrote a book all about animation at work. And so I am curious because a lot of people think that when they hear the term animation, they kind of go towards film and they're like, what do you mean animation on the web? Oh, you mean like making films with SVGs, or are you making cartoons with SVGs? And it's like, sure, but there's also much more subtle ways that still is animation. It's still motion. So my question for you is, what role does animation play in improving user experience and accessibility on the web specifically?
Oh, great question. You're making me remember my good old days working on UI animation. So I did write a book with a book apart. It's called Animation at Work. And I go over about 4 different instances of animation. There are transitions between states. There are, oh my gosh, hang on a minute. I actually have, do I have this book? No, that's not it. Sorry, I am poking around over here because it's like, sometimes you write things and you're like, wait a minute, what did I say in that book that I wrote? It's not next to me, it's out in the living room. But there are stateful transitions, delighters, enter and exits, and I forgot the third one. Forgive me for that. But the useful thing about animation is, before animation, when we developed apps, cause and effect were really hard to link together. So a person would tap something and then the whole screen would change. Or you'd click a button and a whole page would change. And in the early days of the internet, this made sense because it would take a couple of seconds for the page to load. So it was like, click, wait, click, wait, click, wait. But then we got touch. Touch screens made things a little different. the response system of the web and the rendering engine was really snappy. So, you know, it would be like tap and zoom, something would change. It started to change a little too fast for the human eye to keep up. You know, you click the page and then suddenly everything was in a different place because you'd moved on to the next page. So animation made it a little easier to help ease those mental transitions. So pressing the button rather than, you know, clicking and then wondering, did it work? Was it a clickable element? Did it hear me? You would actually see the button depress and then bounce up. And that let you know, yes, you got some feedback. That was the third one. Feedback that your action had a reaction. It had impact. And then an enter-exit animation would bring like a modal onto the page by like changing its opacity so it sort of faded in. And, you know, once you typed into the form and then you hit submit, which would once again give you feedback and animate, the modal would fade back out and exit off the screen. So that's an example of how animation can add utility and make an app feel more interactive. If you try to imagine what that would feel like, you know, like you tap a button, it doesn't respond at all, the page wipes, and then you see another form. You have to do a bit of mental work to tie your tap to the new screen, and it can add some friction. But with animation, you keep everything on page, you keep it very smooth and understandable to the visual processing system, and you reduce that friction for the user.
I think one of the instances where I like felt that not from a visual perspective, but from a touch feel perspective, was I had this iPhone 7, I think it was, and I had that thing for way longer than you would normally have a phone. I was just like, this thing still works. Why get a new phone? But at some point, it was like I really needed to. And one of the reasons was the little home button at the bottom, like its haptic feedback stopped working. And so then you realize that when you press, there's actually nothing depressing. It's a hard surface. It's literally haptic feedback that makes it feel like you press that button. Now it still works, but there's no feedback telling you that, yes, you pressed it. And it seems like such a small thing, but when it disappears, you're like, wow, this is a vastly different experience. So I can 100%, I can 100% understand what you mean by the visual aspect as well.
Now, I'm so glad that you mentioned that. But a lot of my early demos, I actually drew them by hand. I remember I wanted to go to a conference, CSS Conf in Hawaii, CSS Dev Conf. It's no longer happening. It no longer happens, but I went to a lot of them. And my pitch to the CFP process was, I believe I can take CSS animations and HTML5 audio and create an animated music video with them. I really just wanted to go to this conference and wanted to go to Hawaii. I worked for a company that was like, yeah, we're not sending you to any conferences. You're going to have to take PTO for that. And I was like, I will. I want to go see Chris Coyer. And I was so delighted when they were like, yeah, come do it. I knew I could spin straw into gold, but I hadn't actually done it yet. I knew theoretically it was possible. So the next month was a mad dash of me pulling together some hand-drawn cats and sound clips and yeah, it turned into a series of really cool little demos. It was a good time in my life. I felt very fulfilled and creative.
Amazing. Is that because I looked on your website and I found this page that has two courses and one of them has a little cats. Is that related to what you're talking about?
I did take the things that I made and you can find them at courses.rachelneighbors.com. I took all the demos that I made and created a masterclass on CSS animations and transitions. I also think I have a class up there about creative cartooning for technical people. It's a fun little set.
Amazing. So sticking with web animation, but going to a different space with this. So you have a line it's a post that you wrote, I believe, that read, the web animation community doesn't need gatekeepers, it needs gardeners. Now, when I read that, I was like, I 100% hear what you're saying, because I feel that from a web community perspective, but then also open source in general. And it immediately reminded me of a clip I saw from the Changelog, one of their, I think it's the GoTime podcast, where they have these little videos on YouTube called Unpopular Opinion. And the person's opinion was that we should stop gatekeeping in open source by saying stuff like, why would you go and write that thing and put it in open source? Why didn't you instead contribute to this, that, or the other project that does exactly the same thing? And it was like, you should never be shamed for having made something and decided to open source it, even if it's something that already exists, because maybe you did it to learn, maybe you didn't know about the other project. There's a million reasons why you might have done it, but we shouldn't be gatekeeping in that sense. And so when I read that from you, I was like, man, this is just, I feel that. And so I'd love for you to talk about that a little bit more from your perspective, like what was your experience, what led to you writing that? And then also your experience stewarding the Women in React community.
So for the web animation community, at the time that I was stewarding it, I had like a Slack, I had a newsletter, I had all kinds of things. Working on the web animation API, I really enjoyed it. But there were a couple of, I think one or two other people active in the animation community at the time. And I realized that the community building aspect of what I was doing kind of turned me into a gatekeeper. At that time, like accessibility, design systems, etc., they all had these like flagship, you know, they weren't paid by a company. They were just sort of flagship advocates for that space. You know, you would talk to, you'd see Derek Featherstone giving a talk on accessibility. And, you know, he had happened to have an accessibility consultancy and also write a book about it. You know, Val Head and I were in the animation space. Sarah Drasner briefly crested into it with SVG Animations, teamed up with Val, and then, you know, moved on to her illustrious career that she has today. But it was very personality-based, and I thought that was overall not good for the community, because you end up in this situation where people like to cult up around personalities. They like to, you know, like you're on Team Jason or Team whatever the other guy was, I forget. But, you know, you're either really into Sasuke or really into Naruto. And it tends to be more of a divider in communities than it can be a thing that brings them together. The React community is interesting because the React community grew organically and similarly had some big names. You know, there's Dan Abramoff, who's a core contributor, but there's also Ryan Florence, the trainer, and Kent C. Dodds, who makes Epic React. And, you know, like they're the big flagship names. And they don't keep anybody out. Like nobody is, you know, deciding who's getting featured in the newsletter this week. Although there are numerous newsletters that can and cannot, but fortunately, media has spread to so many places that, you know, you can find creators anywhere. Nobody has like the bottleneck on who gets to be seen, which is great. I love that. But we still have the sort of figurehead issue that I had noticed, where people tend to look up to one or two people in the community, and it makes it hard for other people in the community to stand out. I can't really, since Cassidy went off on maternity leave, there hasn't really been a lot of like women I would put up on that position either. So there's just a few people who sort of, their words are very impactful. They tend to look the same, and we revolve around them. I don't feel that's healthy for a community. I feel like we need to structure communities a little bit more egalitarian. Like, there should always be people who are organizing conferences free of profit. There should always be, you know, at least as many people on stage who reflect the makeup of the community. If there are 20% women in the community, 20% of the speakers should be women. But increasingly, I feel that since I wrote that, communities have started to be gardened by people who have a lot to gain from gardening them, even more than back when I built communities. You know, the Reactiflux, I don't think Reactiflux is the one I'm thinking of, but, you know, these membership-only discords, etc., they're great. You can, the people who set them up can garden that one little community, but often they have a price tag for entry, and then you're solely at the beck and call of that person. And if they decide that you don't meet their standards, that's it for you. So I'd like to see more communities in more places. I think that when you see communities moving into walled gardens, I now believe that that is an indication that people in the community aren't being supported correctly. Or not in the way I would.
Yeah, no.
If people have to hide behind a login screen to have a community, perhaps they don't feel safe outside of the wall.
Yeah, that is very true. I've seen that. I kind of moved away from Discord because of fear of that. But then the thing is, then you exclude, right? Because then, I don't know, you know, some people are like, but I don't want to use Slack. I already use Discord. I don't want to use another thing. You know, like I had that because at some point I toyed with the idea of let's use Matrix. It's like open source, da-da-da. And people were like, I don't want to create another account. And then it's like, I get it. So, but you can also not be everywhere because then you become too fragmented and then it's too hard to keep an eye on everything and ensure people are supported, that kind of thing, right? So, yeah, I hear you. But I also do like the idea that you said, like, more communities and not so much just a couple of leaders that each has their tribe walking with them and that's all. And if you don't fit into any of those, you kind of left outside the gates. It reminded me, like, very separate topic, but when I spoke to Zach Leatherman, I asked him about the future of the web and like frameworks and stuff like that. And he was like, well, I'd actually like to see more instead of less. So less of the, this is the one that won. This is the framework that won. Instead, there's a diverse array of different frameworks that you would pick based on what you're doing. It, maybe I'm stretching the parallel here, but it almost feels similar in nature.
No, I think you have a point there. And I like that you're hearkening back to the Zach Leatherman episode. Everyone, make sure you catch up on it.
That was a good one. I really enjoyed chatting with him. And what we talked about now, it kind of leads very nicely into another topic that I wanted to bring up. And that is, there's quite a few, I guess you would call them online magazines these days. Like, people are like, what's a magazine? I don't know what you mean by that. Blog? But anyway, like List Apart, which has been around forever. Like, I've been reading that since I can't even remember when. Smashing Magazine, again, also been on the blog for a very, very long time. And there are some others, but a lot of people don't even know that you could write for those publications, right? You as a web developer, as a front-end engineer, you could write for those magazines and actually get paid if that's what you're interested in. But I think for some people, even if they know that, they might be like, oof, I don't know if I'm good enough to write for that. How is there a gatekeeping aspect to this where it's like only X people can write for this, you shouldn't even try? Or is it us being our own worst enemies and just being like, I'll never be good enough for this?
A little bit of both. When it comes to platforms like publications, like Smashing Magazine or A List Apart or God bless it, CSS Tricks, you very much do have to win the approval of whoever's in charge of what content goes up there. They are looking for certain topics that they know their audience wants to hear about. They're looking for a certain level of authenticity and seniority, and they're looking for people who have good writing skills. And you have to tick all three of those. But they aren't going to hunt you down and say, hey, I would love it if you'd write something. Even if you are posting to your own Substack or Medium or blog even, or dev.to, you're welcome to do those things, but they're unlikely to lead to invitations to post on these sites. And I actually recommend you do start blogging and writing, because whenever you approach, and you will have to approach them, the owners of a publication, and say, hey, I'd like to write for you. They're going to say, well, that's great. Do you have some samples? And they'll want to see you writing about things in other places. And so it is, nothing should stop you from writing. You just won't be part of a curated collection of writings. And I think that's fine. You know, the internet is about 1,000 flowers blooming. And also, you have to trust that the network effects are going to take care of you. If what you write resonates, people will share it with other people. You don't need to rely on, you won't need to necessarily rely on the benediction of a popular editor at a popular website like you used to.
Yeah, no, that's very true. I spoke with my son the other day about the exact same thing, because he kind of wrote a piece, like he's in the gaming world, so he wrote a piece about a game, and I was like, it's good that you wrote the thing, but I feel like you could have done more. And he was like, yeah, but why? Nobody cares about what I'm writing. And so, you know, there. And I was like, well, maybe not today, but if you never really put your heart and soul into it and just write it and put it out there, then people will never find you. They'll never know about you. And when they do run into you, they will think like, ah, this person, they just slap a little thing and put it on there. Like, put your heart and soul into it. Even if there's one person that's reading it, and even if I'm that one person that's reading it, because tomorrow, in a week, in a month, in a year, there might be more people that's interested. And then if you want to write for whatever online websites there are in that space, exactly what you said, they're going to ask you for, can I see some of your writing? And if you point them to a blog with one paragraph blog posts, they're unlikely to say, yeah, sure, write for us.
And believably so. Would you hire an artist who didn't have a portfolio?
Nope.
Yeah, no. I can draw a tattoo for you. Trust me.
Oh, never do that. Those things are permanent. Along the same lines of education, learning, curation, all these kinds of things. I think this harkens back a bit to junior devs. Like, one of the things you always hear is, oh, we need 3 years experience. And they're like, but how am I supposed to get this if I can't even get a job? And I'm not in a position to do a free internship, so I really need a job. Now, I've spoken to multiple people, and I've kind of always brought this topic up, so I thought I'd bring it up with you as well. And it's just the idea of, what role can open source and the open source community and contributing to projects and stuff like that, what role can that play in filling in that gap, that missing piece that many people have, but especially, I think, if we want to speak to people getting into tech, entry-level kind of folks.
I hear you about they want 6 years experience. Number one, don't tell them how many years experience you have. Just tell them the skills that you have and show them what you've built in that situation. Number two, this is the advice that I give anybody who's going through economic hardship. It's advice I wish my mom had taken. We had a tough time growing up. It's something like, the universe hates idle hands. The best thing you can do when you have time is to do something useful, if not for yourself, then for everyone else. This is why we have volunteering opportunities. When you're applying for a job and you haven't been employed in a year, do you want to say, oh, I've been applying for jobs for a year and nobody wants me? I mean, if they don't want you, why would this job want you? Or do you want to say, yeah, it's been a tough year. I keep myself busy. I've been helping out at my local community center, making food for the homeless. Made a lot of good friends that way. Now I have a little neighborhood game that I put together, or I've organized a Slack for other people that graduated at the same time I did and were working on a project to put together an app that's helping community members cope with their long COVID symptoms. Like, these are all way better stories to tell, and they make you be active. They make you keep your skills fresh. They make you go out and explore new skills, and they show this is a person who's not giving in to despair and having a victim mindset. This is a person who's keeping active, keeping their hope bright. And when the chips are down, and they go down, you know, things get tough inside companies, especially during economic moments like this. This is a person I can trust to not completely have a panic attack and collapse onto the deck of the ship. You know, what we need are people who can handle the ropes and steer the ship in stormy waters. That's what people are looking for. And yes, I can hear, I've been on the sad end of the economic scale. I can hear the, but how will I live? I need money on the other side of that scale. Sometimes you just might have to, you know, pick up some odd jobs. I've heard people who've come in and they've been like, yeah, I've been Ubering. I've been working at a Starbucks and I'm working on my side project. Having a side project, having something you do collaboratively with other people to build that teamwork skill, these are fine. And you might have to take a side job for a bit, but it's way better than not doing anything at all. And if that sounds like work, well, jobs are work. And the people who are hiring you for jobs, they like to see that you work. That's partly why you do it. But yeah, I would say try to find some income to tide you over, something that will help you meet the bills, and then find a way to continue investing in your career, but do it in a way that gives back to people you care about, whether that's your family, your community, your colleagues, your kids. Do it. It's always a better story to tell. And when I say a story to tell, I don't mean like superficially. I mean like when you're on your deathbed and you look back on all the stuff that you did, which story do you want to tell yourself? You know, there's which of those two stories sounds better and gives you a better feeling.
Yeah, that's amazing. That's so well said. Wow. Yeah. Wow. And it leads us nicely into what I was wanted to talk about next, because hardships, right? Like, I mean, I left Mozilla in July last year, and with the best intentions of doing my own thing, I'm going to do this consulting thing and it's going to be awesome. And I mean, honestly, if it wasn't for the job that I got now, that I got at the end of November last year, and even with that job for the first like 2-3 months, hell, if it wasn't for family, it would have been hard to put food on the table. Like, it was rough. It was extremely rough because clients just suddenly ran out of money. Who knows? Who knew that happens? And they were just like, sorry, we can't afford you anymore. And it's like, you are like literally my biggest client. And I just lost it overnight. These things happen. And
they do.
Yeah. And then the tech industry now is like, the world's in a weird place. Let's just put that on the table and just, yeah, the world is weird. Like, there's war all over the show. There's just people who don't know what, there's the weird, I don't know. The world is strange at the moment. And then the tech industry kind of, I don't know. There's just people being laid off left and right due to crazy hiring during pandemic, da, 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 all these kinds of things. Some people blame AI. Be it as it may, it's kind of depressing sometimes looking at my LinkedIn feed and just seeing one person after the other saying, I'm on to my next journey, yeah. I'm on to my next journey. And it's like, and 6 months later, the
and same everyone's trying to be stolen. Cheerful about it.
Yeah, exactly. Because 6 months later, you see the same person still saying, I'm still looking for something. And you're like, oh my goodness, how are you? You know, medical aid's a reality in today's life. If you don't have that and your kid gets sick or something, like, that's not a place you want to be. But so uncertainty, not knowing what to expect, it's part of life. But how do we deal with it? Like, you wrote a piece about something that happened in your life that's related to this. It's essentially, don't do what you love. If you want to dig into this very, very deep and philosophical topic, but very real for a lot of people right now.
Yes, I have a I started making comics for a living. And, you know, my mother had always told me, you know, do what you love and you'll never work a day. And oftentimes when we are young, we want to be things like YouTube stars. I remember I wanted fame and fortune. And for me, that meant becoming a cartoonist. And I was going to live off of my income from making comics. And maybe my dream would be I'd get like my own cartoon on Nickelodeon or something. I had no idea how to get there. But this was my dream. And I worked very hard. I self-published 2 graphic novels. But despite success, I won awards. I even had a couple of distributors interested in distributing my book. But women don't read comics, so that didn't work out. But the point was, I had probably the biggest readership of most web comics at that time. It was a really big deal in the early 2000s. But it wasn't enough to get me jaw surgery, and I needed jaw surgery. I didn't have health insurance. And the amount of money was so far from anything I was making, because I was like below the poverty level. I was doing better than most cartoonists. They were like, wow, you're doing so well. I was doing better than the waitresses in my hometown. That lets you know how bad things can get in some areas. And I just had to have a reasonable talk with myself and be like, I know you love this, but it's not helping you. It's not taking you where you need to go. And slowly, the thing I loved doing was not becoming something that brought me joy, but it was becoming a a weight around my neck, something that I struggled with and couldn't figure out why I couldn't sustain myself with, which made me feel like I was lesser than. And that's kind of silly when you think about it. The evidence is stacked high that I'm one of the best in the biz at this phase of my life. I've got the biggest audience. I get the most fan mail. But it's not enough to keep me going. So I looked at my skills and I decided to set off in the direction of, you know, what would people pay me to do? And it turns out that they would pay me to build websites for them. And so I set off in that direction, but I beat myself up about it for a long time because I was like, oh, how could I let go of my fans and blah, blah, blah. And now I look back and I'm like, well, that's a little egotistical. Like, come on, they went on and read other people's comics. Like, you were not the center of the universe. This is not a personal failing. You want to pick a career that loves you back. And that is, you know, tech has loved me back. Recently, it's been tough even for somebody like me, so I imagine it's got to be tough for a lot of people out there right now. You know, you have my sympathy and my empathy there. I'm in a fortunate place in that for the past 6 years, I was in big tech precisely because at one point I was doing web animations and working on the web animation API, and I was like, wow, I really love this, but I'll never be able to buy a house on this. I got to get actual monies. So I went in and I worked at big tech. I did very, very well for myself. Not as well as the people who were smart enough to be doing it since day one, of course. But that can get you into a different set of existential angst, by the way. We can talk more about golden treadmills in a moment. But the point was that I feel fortunate that I was able to use my skills to set aside enough that I feel secure now. And I can wait out a storm like this. But getting to that point is the challenge. Getting to the point where you can look outside and be like, wow, it looks really crummy out there. And just sort of say, yeah, you know what? It's a great time for me to study deep learning and contribute to my favorite open source project with my friends. Like, that's a privileged place to be in. If I had had to do that at the outset of my career, which I actually did have to do, I got laid off during the original recession. And that was really hard. I ended up taking on a lot of odd jobs, etc. But I made it work and I made my way through. But if you can take some time to reskill or build something you're proud of, I would recommend it overtaking a job where you're undervalued or you're working with people who don't treat you well. I highly recommend. Make sure you work with excellent people. Prioritize the people that you work with. Make sure they're nice. Make sure they're smarter than you are. And that will pay off dividends later even me, like, I had no job at the start of the recession. And now I'm very successful because I continue to invest in working with smart people on great projects. I wish I'd started doing that sooner. So I'm speaking from all the misadventures I've had here when I say this.
Yeah, which is, I think, most people's lives, right? You always look back and say, if I only. And then I'm very careful to not go there, because I can really get into that hole proper, you know, where it's like, oops, I think I dig a little too deep. Now I'm not so sure if I'm ever going to get out of this hole. Because, I mean, very much like you with the cartoons, I was a classical guitarist. I mean, I went to Europe, I played there, but I couldn't make a living from it, right? I couldn't support my family. And so back then it was Flash, and I was like, ooh, with this thing, I can move objects, I can add sound, and I can do all these cool things. It kind of feels a bit art music related, so let me do that. And then I ended up making websites for a living. I still miss it dearly, and I still wish it could have worked out, but at least I found something else which I find fulfilling, right? Like what you said, that's what you need in the end of the day. So if you can find something that's fulfilling, and if it can pay the bills, that's bonus points for sure.
Yes, I 100% agree with you on that. And also, that's really cool that you're a professional musician. I think that it never hurts to bring that part from your previous life into your new life. I gained a lot from knowing how to make comics readable when I came into web development and design, and I'm sure that you bring something from music with you into programming.
Yeah, I hope so.
Some of the best programmers I know are professionally trained classical musicians.
It is not an uncommon thing to say, I was a musician before I did the web, and they're like, really? Look behind me, and it's like guitars or drums or something. And it's like, I see it. The golden treadmill, if you want to cycle back to that one. I think I know what you're talking
Absolutely.
About.
Absolutely. This is the flip side of this coin. So for people who like got into hot startups or big tech, especially big tech. I think startup people who left college and got into a startup like Facebook, they're doing really well right now, and they're chill. Like, they have enough that they're able to wholeheartedly step away from the industry and go do other things with their lives, which is kind of amazing. It's like graduation. But for people who graduated from university and then they, for instance, started at one of the older companies like Microsoft or let's just say anybody at a FAANG company starting today, like starting after their gigantic boom in the stock price, you know, like those few shares you started with 10 years ago are worth so much more now than the few shares that you're going to get when you join today will be in 10 years. So there's a definite timing advantage, depending on when you enter the market. But some people, especially there's this special generation of people who join these companies after they've done their hockey stick growth, and they're making six figures, and that should on paper make them well-to-do. But because of the inherent limitations of the lifestyle, you know, you have to live in a city with lots of tech in it, which means you're competing with everyone else making the same amount of money, as well as the people who made lots of money earlier, which forms kind of like seven layers of hierarchy. So you want to hang out with them, you get this lifestyle inflation, you know, we got to get our seasons passed to the snow fields. I couldn't possibly leave my job because then how would I send my kids to Harvard and still go skiing? And, you know, like, it becomes impossible to step away. They call it golden handcuffs. But I also see a golden treadmill, which is where, you know, if I just stay at this thing long enough, I'm going to get the promo. I'm going to get the directorship. I'm going to, you know, my company tells me they love me. I really feel like we're a family here. I know people who are laid off from Google where for them, it was devastating. It was their first big tech job, and they felt like it was a family. They were doing the career ladder thing, and then they were just gone. And that had never happened there before. And that's the golden treadmill. It's when you're walking forward and you're just plowing all your energy into a company because you genuinely believe that you're going to, it's going to, you know, result in something great. But for most people, and we are not going to see the kind of returns that the original founders did. We're not going to see the job security that tech has looked to have for the past 20 years. It's cyclical. There was a dot-com bust before this. There will be an AI bust and a VR bust again. There will always comes in cycles. But we had a really long, good run. And I think we got a little complacent. And for people who got into this industry because they really believed that they could do it, that it would lead them to the life they wanted, this has been a rude awakening. Not an unexpected one on my part, but I can see how it would really break hearts. And to that, I gotta say, you know, there's a saying, Bruce Lee, in the middle of chaos lies opportunity. And you can look back when I got laid off in my first tech job during the recession. That was when all the big open source projects that now run AWS, they got started then. The recession was a great time to go back to school or to build something great with friends. It was not the best time to get a high-paying job. And I think now that's something to keep in mind. You may not get the six-figure job, but you're also not going to be on the golden treadmill or have the golden handcuffs and be carefully watching stock reports, wondering if you're going to be able to take care of your mortgage and your kids. You're hopefully in a place where you can be smaller, leaner, more decisive about where you put your time and make some good bets. All these smart people are free-floating around in the community now, and they're available to do things. Take advantage of that.
Yeah, well said. What do you think of AI right now? Good, bad, indifferent?
There is nothing good nor bad, but thinking makes it so. To mangle some Shakespeare. Yeah, the AI, it's like the web. It's a tool. It'll be used for good. It'll be used for bad. It changes things. And it will continue to change things because we're only at the beginning. And in 2 to 5 years, what you see today is going to be significantly better. So anyone who's like, yeah, I'll never get that good. Well, they are probably scared. And maybe they have reason to be scared. For me, I mean, the web changed how mailrooms work. Mailroom jobs are few and far between now. They used to be full of people. And AI is going to change the kind of work that we do, too. Web also increased the number of delivery jobs there are. We didn't know that it was going to do that. I think AI is a great tool. It allows us to do things like have those conversations, which can be positive, gives us the confidence to walk into conversations with people we normally would shy away from speaking with, and negative, could tell us false information, could make us less likely to interact with other human beings. In that regard, I'm bullish when it comes to AI. I think it's like a mecha suit we can put on to do things faster. I might be able to wrangle an entire documentation code base on my own instead of having to, you know, common story with documentation managers is like, we never have enough people. Well, with, you know, LLMs, we might be able to ingest an entire code base and then come up with boilerplates whenever it updates. And the AI could help us manage the documentation as a byproduct of the code rather than reacting to the code. I think that's a beautiful idea, and I hope that we can build systems like that, that evolve and grow with us and make our lives more manageable. So I'm not scared. I'm not scared of AI. I just think that the people's reaction to AI is probably the scarier thing. The company that throws away 60% of its workforce because, yeah, there was a report that we could automate some of this stuff. And then they realize, oh, no, you can't. Not yet. And you just threw away all the people who'd help you. Like, that is the sort of thing that scares me the most, is what people are going to do in reaction. And also, of course, the ways that it will be abused. Deepfakes. People are so gullible, and it would be so easy to just really not, you know, what is it, the era of hallucinations. It's possible we could be living in an era where we just can't tell truth from fiction anymore. And that those two things, the era of hallucinations and human responses to the promises of AI, are the things that scare me.
Yeah, well said. And those are hallucinations without the need for a hallucinogenic, because there's also quite an age of hallucinogenics going around, you know, finding the good in it, finding the ways that it can help people who have gone through some rough things in their lives and people who deal with depression and these kinds of things.
Absolutely.
Yeah. These are the ones where it would tell you that Ada Lovelace wasn't a programmer. And you're like, wait, what? No, I think you're wrong there. And it's like, oh, sorry. Yeah, the common response, if you point out that maybe it there was an error, it's, oh, yeah, sorry. Thank you for pointing that out. In fact, X, Y, Z, and then it's maybe a further hallucination. So one has to be careful for those things. But I agree. I mean, I was very skeptical when it started. 100% honest. I think there's even still a thing on my Substack about that. But I think my biggest concern was it creating a new, what do you call that? No, my mind has gone somewhere else. Digital divide. So, you know, there was this digital divide that happened because those that have access and those that do not. And I was afraid of that. Open source has kind of leveled the playing field, you know, having access to stuff like Hugging Face with all those spaces that are running all the latest models and all these. So it's helping a lot. But I think that was one of my biggest concerns, is there going to again be this, oh, there's this group of people that have access to all these amazing tools and they're just flourishing. And then all these other people that don't have access and therefore they're kind of left behind the dust. But I've seen that people have been resourceful. And as a result, I've kind of changed my mind about some of it and said, like, it would be a good idea for you to learn how to use these things to your benefit. Because, yeah, if anybody will lose their job, it's probably people who don't know how to use these tools to their benefit, as opposed to it just coming in and saying, we no longer need you. It's more like...
I heard somebody once say it, the AI isn't going to replace your job. The AI isn't going to take your job. The person using AI is going to take your job. And I think that is a really good way of putting it. And I know some people, they have a tendency to like dig in and be like, I'm not going to buy ebooks. I think paper books have a place in humanity, blah, blah, blah. You know, like, good for you. I appreciate that you have your own values and integrity, but you're also going to have to choose which side of the equation you want to be on when it comes to using new tools and, you know, facing competition that does. There will be a generation born from now for whom using AI is second nature, the same way children born today are given laptops as, well, iPads as electronic babysitters. And they will do their work very differently from how this generation does it. You can keep up, or you can, you know, stick to your guns and maybe, I don't know, take care of forest trails or something. That sounds like a really nice job. A lot of people quit tech and just go work on farms. I'm not judging, but you will have to make that decision for yourself. I don't think there's any harm in learning new tools and exploring and playing. It's what got us into this industry. At least I'm hoping that's what brought people here and not the promise of six-figure salaries, which are very attractive. But you got to have some heart, too.
100%. 100% agree. Well, this has been an incredible conversation. I have a couple of things. Before you tell us how people can find and support you, you're writing a book in public. Do you want to tell us a bit more about that?
I am writing a book at Nearest Neighbors, spelled N-A-B-O-R-S, like my last name, .substack.com. I am writing a book which I have temporarily titled How to Survive Your Tech Career. There are a lot of books that are written about, like, how to get your first tech job, how to be a manager. Sort of like there are lots of books on how to get a date, how to get married, and, you know, how to repair relationship problems. But there aren't a lot of books on just, like, here's how to have a good relationship. You know, this is, you know, like, this is what's expected of you. Assembling IKEA furniture, picking up your clothes, how do you split the chores, that sort of thing. There aren't a lot of books about that, and there are not a lot of books about that for tech either. Like, how do internal hierarchies work? What do you do when someone keeps butting heads against you? I've had a lot of mentors over the years. I've had a lot of mentees as well, and I've done a lot of therapy. And people have gotten a lot out of some words of wisdom I've shared, like how to search for your next job before you're ready to leave your first job, to make sure that you get the best opportunities and you're not in a bad place mentally. And people feel like, oh, I'm betrayed by company. No, you're not. Company is not a person. It doesn't lie awake at night and think about you. And, you know, you're not wounding its pride. Your manager may have some difficulties with emotional boundaries, but that says more about your manager than you. So I am sharing this information on my Substack as I'm working through this content. One day I'm going to put it all together into that neat little survival guide. But for right now, you can find some pretty cool, if I say so myself, some pieces on navigating organizational change and dealing with emotional dysregulation. So yeah, I hope you'll check it out, and I hope you benefit from it.
Amazing. So then, officially in closing, how can people find you and support you in the work you do?
You can find me at all my socials at x.com/RachelNeighbors. I have them all. Please pick whichever one you like. I try to speak on all of them. I don't always. But it's my pinned tweet there. If you are interested in UI animation, you can check out my book at abookapart.com. It's Animation at Work. And otherwise, just go forth and help out your favorite open source project. Go do good in this world.
That's a beautiful way to end it. Thanks so much, Rachel.
Thank you very much.
Thank you for listening to the Mechanical Ink podcast. If you enjoyed this episode, share it with your friends. Leave us a review on Apple Podcasts and Spotify. Have something to add? Continue the conversation on GitHub and join the community on Slack. Until the next one, keep all the things open.